Welcome to The Director's Chair, a Lowy Institute podcast. My name is Michael Fawley-Love and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. On The Director's Chair, I sit down with political leaders, policymakers, and commentators in order to understand what's happening in the world. I'm delighted that my guest on this episode of The Director's Chair is an old friend of the Lowy Institute's, the Governor-General of Australia, His Excellency David Hurley. David is a professional soldier whose military career spanned more than four decades. He served as Chief of the Defence Force from 2011 to 2014, after which he was appointed Governor of New South Wales, and then, in 2019, Governor-General. I came to know David when he was Governor of New South Wales, partly because he chaired the New South Wales Road Scholarship Selection Committee, of which I was a member, and I was always impressed by his deft chairmanship of that committee, which could get a bit heated from time to time. But also during that period, David regularly attended Lowy Institute events. He never stood on ceremony, always happy to sit in the audience with our other guests. And that's one of the things I admire about David Hurley. He's a low-key and humble person, which can't be said for every viceregal I've ever met. David is breaking new ground today. I don't know for sure, but I think he might be the first Governor General to appear on a podcast. So David Hurley, thank you for joining me on the Director's Chair, direct from Yarralumla.
So, Michael, thank you very much, and really delighted to be part of the program today and just look forward to the interaction with you.
David, I want to start by asking about your background. I think your dad was a steelworker and you grew up in Port Kembla. Tell us a bit about your family and your upbringing.
Well, Michael, that's correct. I was born in Wollongong Hospital. Parents lived in Port Kembla for a very short period. Then we moved to Warrawong, which was just another sort of steel city suburb on Lake Illawarra there. Attended Port Kembla infants, primary and high school before I joined the army at 18. My father worked for the Commonwealth Rolling Mills for a while on the factory floor and then became a foreman later in his life. And my mother worked in retail, what I can remember as a child, in the fruit shop across the road, the veggie shop. Both of them left school early. You know, they didn't finish their formal education. Both had to go to work to support families. So, you know, it was a background that you didn't get everything you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I know parents sacrificed a lot for my two sisters and I. I've got one older and one younger. Education was important to them, so making sure we were, you know, attending school and doing all the work we're supposed to do. And if we got into trouble at school, then there was no defense of us in that. If we got into trouble, we must have done something wrong. Yeah, look, I had a lovely childhood. Playing rugby league, cricket, those were the sort of things we played in those days. Good clubs, nothing flashy about it. No great big holidays or anything like that, but it was a warm experience. It was also, I suppose, early exposure to multicultural life because in my school, at Port Kembla High School, kids from former Yugoslavia, Greece, Italy, Spain, we were very multicultural and I probably ran into red wine, spaghetti, and all those sorts of things, knew what a delicatessen was before half of Australia did, because that was the life you had. And, you know, if you went home after school to a mate's place, you didn't get a cake or a sandwich. You know, were straight out of Southern Europe. That's what you ate. You know, what's this green thing that floats in oil? It's an olive. Well, what do they do? So I think that was probably very useful when I was, you know, growing up and doing other things because none of it was foreign. I'd lived in or lived beside foreign and different cultures as a child.
So tell me, you grew up in this environment. How did you get into your head that you wanted to become a soldier?
No great patriotic calling. So this is when I finished school in 1971. It was still expensive to go to university. I matriculated well and could have gone to any university in New South Wales, I dare say, or I knew if I'd chosen to. I really had my heart set on going to Sydney Uni to study archaeology. I did my sums though, and I thought, it's going to be hard to keep myself, study, so forth. Is there another way of doing it? My school had introduced school cadets 2 years beforehand. I received a scholarship, the old Duntroon scholarships, to see me through high school with no ties to it. And I just said, well, I could go to Duntroon. There's a tertiary education to be provided there. If I don't like it afterwards, I dare say I can resign and go off and do something different. Little did I know it wasn't that easy. But I got to Duntroon and primarily for tertiary education.
And what was your experience like at Royal Military College Duntroon? Because, of course, afterwards, I think there were inquiries and scandals about some of the behaviour at Duntroon in that period. What was your experience like?
Yeah, so I joined in 72. That was 3 years after the 69 big bastardisation scandal hit Duntroon. So I think the army at that time was very, very conscious about what was happening in the college at that time. Mm. And my senior class, for example, were the fourth class in 1969. So they'd been through it. Mm. And so they were very wary about it as well. I mean, my recollections, I, again, think very fondly of it. I still have very good mates there. I dare say we did some silly things during that time. And silly and not in the sense of bad, but, you know, if you look back at now, childish, you know, university pranks, that sort of thing. But overall, good professional instructors, both officers, senior NCOs, warrant officers. I mean, Keith Payne, VC, was my weapons training instructor. Mm-hmm. Bob Buick from Long Tan, the turn sergeant, was my rugby coach for a while, and infantry minor tactics. All my instructors were Vietnam veterans, you know, across the board. So we were in very good hands, and I think the army was very experienced at that time, very, very professional, and they went around teaching us quite well, I thought.
Mm.
So I walked out. You know, when I graduated, I didn't look back and say, well, that was a terrible experience or anything like that. I grew a lot, of course, during it, learned a hell of a lot, but not enough. And when I left, I thought I was ready to be a platoon commander. I soon learned that I wasn't quite, but I left with some confidence.
Now, in the period when you were a young officer, the Australian Army wasn't deployed abroad too much, certainly compared to the last decade or two. And I guess, therefore, your career played out differently from the career of a young officer graduating from Duntroon 20 years later, when she or he might have served in East Timor, the Solomon Islands, Iraq, Afghanistan. What have you observed over the course of your career? How did your career, therefore, differ from, you know, later generations of soldiers?
Yeah. So when I graduated, so that was 75, the first real deployment from the ADF above individuals going to UN and so forth was, I think, 91, 92, when we went to Namibia.
Mm.
So sort of 15 years of no major deployments. So we trained our rear ends off, I think. You know, all those big exercises in Northern Australia. When we used to tell our European colleagues later on that we travelled 2,000 kilometres to get to an exercise, they couldn't believe it. We were very well trained. We, as I said, we had a good generation of experienced people training us and looking after us and leading us. They trained us hard. We did some, you know, magnificent exercises and so forth, but we didn't have that combat edge in that generation. And many of my classmates left after about 10, 12 years or so, went off into civilian careers and so on. When I became a battalion commander in 92, 93, when we went to Somalia, I had platoon commanders marching straight into the battalion who went off on an operation, you know, within days of arriving in the battalion. And then it rolled on in the 90s to now. You can't compare the two directly. We were longing to go. We thought we were ready to go and do what the government might ask us to do. And I think we were well prepared to go. I think that experience, I hope, translated into training of the sort of 90s generation.
Mm.
And then that generation now have, you know, they've got different experiences, and most of them are deployed, many of them, vast majority are deployed in operation. So you build another sort of generation like I had training me, who are training the Army, the Defence Force now. And that's got to be a good thing, because they know risk. They know they value lives. Mm. They look after their people well. So those sort of things come out of it. I mean, I was very fortunate. I was on two overseas postings in that sort of 15-year period. So I spent just over 2 years with the Irish Guards and the British Army of the Rhine during the Cold War days. Saw a big army at work inside a bigger system, which really, I think, helped you in the longer term.
What did you notice about the British Army as opposed to the Australian Army?
Look, you'll hear all sort of myths when you're younger about the role of officers and the role of NCOs and so forth. There's all a lot of rubbish, frankly. Very, very professional army. There's a professional core to their officer corps. Yes, there are family links that come in and out, but they're not necessarily played out operationally. warrant officers and sergeant NCOs are just the salt of the earth. Mm. You know, in Irish Guards, only a one battalion regiment. You could be a guardsman for 10 years before you got your first stripe. And so there's a lot of experience in them, a lot of depth. I used to say the Irish Guards always frustrated me for being Irishmen. They would do everything the wrong way around, but end up getting the job done anyway. And one of the beauties of those types of regiments is if you tell them hold that line, they will hold that line.
Mm.
It's just genetically bred into them. So you learn a lot from those people. I would think compared to Australia, different attitude. We're a patrolling army.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, Brits were very much a mechanized army going to war on the plains of Europe. But that training was useful.
David, by the time you reached senior ranks in the Australian Army, the operational tempo was extremely high, and you were, as Chief of Joint Operations, as VCDF, and then as Chief of Defence Force, you're personally involved in a lot of these big deployments abroad, including Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, when you look back on it, when you look back on those forever wars, what do you think Australia and its coalition partners achieved in Afghanistan and Iraq? In retrospect, was it worth it?
I think when you look at Afghanistan, that's always going to be the question people ask. You know, we lost 41 lives there. We committed a lot to it, and a lot of people went through it. But I think we went for all the right reasons. And we learned, you know, militarily, we learned a lot from it. Working with a coalition of 53 countries, I hope we learned politically and strategically about management of those things. We certainly learned a lot on the ground. At the end of it, whatever the outcome is in Afghanistan, and we hope that it's one that we can be supportive of and that takes the country forward in the direction we tried to build it, I think we did our darndest to give them the best chance to make the best decisions for themselves.
And what about Iraq? What about the Iraq war?
Similar. People will be well read on this, the schisms in that society, the pressures on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like, you know, it's a country that's squashed by many players all around it, and it has its own internal issues. Again, I think we went over there with the best of intention to give them the opportunity to make decisions on their own. And if it hasn't played out that way, I don't think it's a failing of ours in the sense of not trying hard enough. That was not going to be an outcome that we could actually achieve in the end. There's just too many players, too many factors involved in it. But the intent to be there to give them an opportunity, I think, is a fair thing.
In the later stages of your military career, in particular as VCDF and then CDF, you dealt with a lot of prime ministers and a lot of defence ministers. I'm not going to make life awkward for you and ask you to rank them, but was there one prime minister or one defence minister you particularly enjoyed working with?
Well, Michael, I had five prime ministers, six ministers, and five deputy ministers of defence in about a 10-year period.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a collection in there. Not fair to rank them and not quite fair to pull out names. I did enjoy working with John Faulkner before he became the minister when he was in opposition. John Faulkner walking into Senate estimates would send tremors down people. What he's going to ask today. But I thought as a defence minister, he understood us to a large degree. And very straight, which was great.
Let me ask you, in terms of Australia's role in the world, how do you think we should balance our role as a significant player in our own region versus our role as a member of the Western Alliance and a country with global interests? So, for example, if you go to the War Memorial, you'll see that Australians have served all around the world, from the Dardanelles and Greece and Crete to China during the Boxer Rebellion and Egypt and Palestine. And that's the history of our deployments, but obviously most of our interests lie in our immediate region, and that's where and power and wealth are shifting towards Asia and the Pacific. How do you think we should strike the balance between our global and our regional responsibilities?
Yeah, it's a big question, Michael. I think you're right to say that the vast majority of our interests lie in the region, and a significant effort goes into pursuing those interests and working on shared issues with our neighbours in the region. But we have a heritage, largely European, that's difficult to walk away from.
Mm-hmm.
And inside that heritage are many of the values and the, you know, what shaped us as a culture, you know, the white culture, at least in Australia, for generations. So it's hard to separate yourself from that. And particularly if it's under stress or in difficult times, like the pandemic and the consequences of it. So I think we just have a natural link back to saying they are values. You know, we come from a line of thinking out of the Enlightenment and so on. That's led us to, you know, have the perceptions of the world we have today. And most of that, all of that is worth defending or supporting. So you're linked there.
Mm.
It's not our biggest trade area, but we've got significant trade links with those countries. So we have interests there. Are they interests that you would go right to the edge for? Well, that's for, you know, you make that decision when you read them on the day, but you would not take your eye off them.
Mm.
And I think tied to the empire and the Commonwealth in the past, we demonstrated that we would go and do something about those things, whether we're not moot point today. But I think the region is, you know, our highest priority. And will be into the future. And again, with where the globe might end up, the world might end up, when the pandemic is sort of reined in, what happens in this region is really going to shape our future.
David, in October 2014, you were appointed as Governor of New South Wales. You were the 38th person to occupy this office, which was held by Arthur Phillip and Lachlan Macquarie and others. You've now served in two viceregal roles, first as Governor of New South Wales and then as Governor General. What's the best thing about being a viceregal?
Meeting Australians.
Mm.
Yeah, to be brutally frank about it. The longer I've been in the positions, the more I meet, the more reinforced I am about just how good our people are.
Mm.
Now, during the pandemic, Linda and I have been on the phones or using every virtual meeting app known to man to link up with mayors of local government areas, community leaders, schools, following up after the bushfire with RFS captains and CFA and so on. Spoken to probably 200 chairs and or CEOs of not-for-profits, those in the social services delivery area. And after every one of those conversations, I come away saying, wow, there are some good quality people out there doing great works. And the way people, particularly in response to the pandemic, have adapted and led their organizations, I think is really commendable. So, you know, I don't wring my hands about Australia. Yes, we've got some big issues ahead of us, given how, you know, what's come out of the pandemic, you know, particularly in the economic and the social disruption that will cause. But, you know, we've got good quality people at many, many levels in our country, good leadership. So if we're going to be relying on them to help us get the communities through, I think it's not a high risk. They're good quality people. So that's what excites me. And, you know, in this position, it's absolutely amazing what people will say to you. There's a tremendous trust in the appointment of Governor General, and that sort of rubs off then on the person occupying the position. But people will just open up to you and you come away from the end of the day. You might be dead beat, but you're uplifted with the quality of the engagement, the quality of the people. So 90% of our time is engaging with the Australian public, and long may that be the case, because it's a great job when you're doing that. And another aspect of seeing Australians and the good work they do and the strength of character of them is obviously in the recipients of the Order of Australia. You just see amazing people who have invested so much of their energy and their self into our community. In recent times, there has been some criticism of the list that have come out, particularly in the matter of the number of women being nominated. We're working hard to increase the diversity. And if I could just put a plea into your listeners that if you're in a position in an organization that has the ability to nominate, and everyone should be able to nominate, people who are doing good works, who meet the criteria, the merit criteria for the award, please do. We need to have more women nominated, and our multicultural Indigenous representation is not where it should be. So again, just a request through this means to people to put a bit of thought and time into that for me. Thank you.
David, when you were governor, you trained each day with Indigenous boxers at a gym in Redfern as part of the Tribal Warrior Program, a fitness program led by Redfern community leaders and police. And you were affectionately known, I think, as the Governator, or Gov, by several young men at the gym. Now, there are probably gyms that are closer to Government House than that one. Why did you decide to train every day with Tribal Warrior in Redfern?
It sort of came about by a series of decisions, as these things do, because when I became governor, and really I wanted to make sure I controlled my destiny and not have it controlled for me. So I sat down and worked out a strategic plan and what were my sort of major themes or lines of approach in the military sense you would say I wanted to follow. One was Indigenous youth development, leadership, what's going on in those areas. So early on, we went and visited, Linda and I went and visited the National Centre of Indigenous Excellence at Redfern. I didn't see Tribal Warrior on that occasion, sort of bumped into them, but didn't see them doing their work. But I noticed they had a great gym, and I needed somewhere to go and keep fit. So I said, right, that's only sort of 10 minutes drive away. So I went down there one morning, and I was up in a mezzanine level looking down on the basketball courts, and I could see all these Aboriginal people boxing away and whatever. And I said, well, that looks like fun. And it will work me harder than I'm working myself. So the next day I went down there and just said to someone, can you join in? And they said, yeah, please come in. So I just started boxing with them. And about a month or so after I'd been there, I think the penny dropped with somebody that, oh, this guy is the governor. And so I had a few taps on my shoulders. Are you who we think we are? And then the relationship blossomed after that. So again, it was one of those, you know, fortuitous decisions you make in life, because I knew a bit about them, but not too much. But as I grew to know more, it's to help young kids grow. And the number of school captains in primary schools that have come out of that group is amazing. We had prisoners from Long Bay who were in their final year, who would come along and box, and this was to help them develop. You know, you need three things to survive when you get out of jail. That's a job, that's a network, and that's accommodation. And we could provide that for people. And I think of the number of young Aboriginal men who came out of Long Bay who worked with us for a year or so. Many of them went on to have their own jobs. A couple ran their own businesses. And I think only one I can recall had to go back. And, you know, you're always mindful that there's a victim to crime. But if the job is to turn people's lives around so they're not doing it again, I think it was a very successful program to be part of.
David, in 2019, you received a battlefield promotion, as it were, to Governor General of Australia. And when you were sworn in, the first words that you spoke in were the language of the local Aboriginal people, the Ngunnawal people. Why did you decide to do that? And in your interactions with the Australian people, what have you concluded about reconciliation between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians?
Yeah, look, I spent four and a half years as Governor of New South Wales and visited quite a large number of Aboriginal communities around New South Wales. It's mixed what you see out there, some great communities, others really struggling. In my observations, I saw what I thought were problems in the way we were trying to tackle some of the issues, because much of what we do in the, or we're doing in the Indigenous space is driven by short-term programs. You know, 12 months funding, 2 years funding. It's very unstable in that sense. There's a lot of change. And yeah, what could my, I was always thinking, hey, what can I do to try to have a positive effect on that? So I think first of all, and one of the reasons I'm learning Indonesian is learning a language helps you understand the culture. And I think, yeah, one of the gaps we suffer from at the moment is that we just don't understand Indigenous culture well enough to take all the positives from it that we need to take in the future. And again, you've often heard me quote, or people may have heard me quote, a young fellow I did boxing with at Redfern who said to me one day, you know, Gov, what you don't understand is our culture is your culture. And I thought, that's right, but it works on two levels. We don't understand the culture, and we don't understand that it is our culture. And that's just a wonderful invitation for us to come in and learn about the culture. So if I could demonstrate that one of the ways of learning about culture is trying to understand some of the language. yes, there's not one language in Australia, as there might be in New Zealand. I often hear that complaint. Well, tough. You deal with what you deal with. And we don't have too many extant languages in Australia, Aboriginal languages. We have words and smattering from some. But just going that little bit and going, say, okay, how do I do this? And it's just great to see it happening in schools because it's a way in. It's a way to understand. And if you can talk to each other or understand why you use this word, it teaches you how people think. And if you understand how people think, then you can get on better with them. So it was more, you know, not flashy or anything, like more to demonstrate, look, there's something we need to do here. And it's to get closer. Reconciliation. Look, we're on the path, of course. Recent changes have a lot of positives about them in policy. Of course, there'll be disagreements about some aspects of it. That's the way of these things. But I think we've got to get into our minds. It's like defense cultural change. Culture change is a long-term investment. It's generations deep. And yes, you can get short wins and so forth, but you've got to stick to things. And if we've decided what are the five or six best things we need to do here, that's what we've got to drive long-term. So that's not a criticism of policy per se, but the implementation of policy sometimes I think need a bit more stickability. Terrible word, but that's what we need. Yeah, so I'm confident. We've got some big issues ahead of the nation over the next couple of years to talk about in relation to this. The discussions are happening, and I think that's good that there are a lot of people participating. But we will come to a point where we as a nation are going to have to make some big decisions. And I hope that people are thinking this through and thinking about what Australia they would like to see in the future.
Speaking of language, you mentioned Bahasa. I remember you speaking to a number of Indonesian visitors to the Lowy Institute in Bahasa when you were governor. And of course, we all remember when President Joko Widodo of Indonesia came to Australia and he attended a reception at Government House. You were able to address him and his delegation in Bahasa. How's your Indonesian going? And can you tell us a little bit about the importance of Indonesia to Australia as a country?
Well, my Indonesian has dropped off the curve slightly over the last few months because I signed up to attend classes at ADPA with the cadets because I needed more face-to-face time and discussion with people. But a month after I did that, the pandemic hit, and so we've gone to online learning, which is exactly what I didn't need. But it's useful. I can, with a bit of help with the dictionary every now and again, or more often than not, I can read, I can give a speech and craft a speech. My sort of day-to-day discussion skills aren't where I want them to be, but I'll work on that. Again, it's a pathway to understanding Indonesians. When I was the vice chief and CDF had, as you can imagine, quite a number of significant engagements with Indonesia and the TNI during that period, I'm very firmly of the view that working together in the region, we can do a lot of good. And I'm very mindful of, you know, Indonesia's position in ASEAN and the philosophies behind that and so forth. But we have a lot of shared interests, I believe.
Mm.
We can't make too much of the it's a critical relationship, therefore we must be friends. No, it's a critical relationship, but we've got to work hard to be friends. And there will always be differences between us, we know that. But for me, wanting to play a positive role in driving that relationship to improve it, to get it to a level where, as I used to say, dampen the amplitude of the ups and downs in the relationship and level it out. And as I think we are now, moving away from just being in permanent crisis management mode to a solid understanding of each other's needs and requirements and what the relationship brings to each other and managing it in that space.
Mm.
You know, before I was asked to become the Governor General, was my intention when I retired as Governor of New South Wales to go to DFAT, just give him my telephone number and say, look, if you need someone to deliver a message, attend a conference, give a speech, won't cost you a penny, just give me a call, I'll happy to help out. And I just think it's something that we can invest more in. And I look at the results of your surveys and other institute surveys about Australian attitudes to Indonesia, and I'm very disappointed, you know, when people don't understand that Indonesia's a democracy, has been for 20 years, that that there is significant change going on in that country. And, you know, views of trustworthiness of Indonesians, that upsets me. So I think there are areas there we've got to develop and work on. And again, learning language, understanding culture helps you do that.
I'm pretty sure DFAT doesn't need your business card. They've got your number, and you do go overseas and give speeches for them and for us from time to time. And let me ask you, sometimes it's revealing to see, to look at yourself through someone else's eyes. And so I want to ask you, when you travel overseas, in particular as Governor General, I know you did some travel before COVID hit. How do you find the world perceives Australia? Is there something we can learn from the way the rest of the world sees us?
You know, of course, it depends which countries you go to and what experiences they've had with Australia. You know, South Korea, for example, very, very appreciative of the role Australia played back in the Korean War, and that carries through. I was quite surprised to how that came into virtually every opening conversation. And they still see us that way. They don't think our character is moved. Reliable, good friend. You go to Vietnam, who has a, you know, comes from a different experience with us, completely different experience, yet they respect us. And they know that they can have hard conversations with us. And we're true to where we're going, you know, what we say we're going to do. So I think there's enormous respect out there. We have history in many countries. I mean, you just walk into this, the Anzac Shrine in Hyde Park in Sydney and look where we've been. We have relationships around the globe. And I can't recall ever being in a country where respect and appreciation for what we've done in the past, or the qualities and the straight shooting sort of qualities people see in us, are not enormously respected. And, you know, sometimes people will, they will say something glowing about Australia, and you'll say to yourself, well, you don't know us that well. But I think they look to Australia as a country that's made a over 100 or 200 years now in sort of modern history for us, has created a country you can be proud of. And we always say, yes, it has some failings and issues with it. But people look at it and they see it in very positive terms. And I think, I don't think we appreciate that sometimes. You know, Australians are very cynical, very hard on themselves. And but other countries, I think, are more forgiving. You know, they might have policy differences with you and whatever, but you know, talk about the country as a whole. Good people, dependable, will tell you what they think, and with a sense of humour.
David, you mentioned at the beginning that you grew up playing rugby league, and I want to finish the interview with a rugby league question, if I can. I think I my memory is when I saw photos of you in the paper boxing with Tribal Warrior and Redfern, you would sometimes wear a South Sydney jersey. I know as Governor General, you need to be completely impartial and above important matters like rugby league. But can I ask you, did you happen to catch South Sydney's win over the Sydney Roosters 60-8 the other week? And what are the chances of a South Sydney premiership in 2020, do you think?
Well, I was at the game, so I came away with a big smile on my face. Look, I think if you could reproduce that form another 4 weeks, you'll win the competition, this hands down. I think the problem for Wayne Bennett this week will be keeping their feet on the ground and their heads out of the clouds, because every game's a different game. But put your money on South if you're a betting person.
All right. Thank you for speaking with me today, David Hurley, on the director's chair. You said that as governor and as governor general, people open up to you. Thank you for opening up to us, and I think you revealed a lot of your integrity and your humility and your public-spiritedness as an individual. So thank you and good luck.
Michael, thanks very much, and thank you to all those who are listening. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Director's Chair, a podcast by the Lowy Institute, hosted by me, Michael Fullilove, with production assistance from Madeline Neist. Thanks for listening, and please tune in to the next episode of The Director's Chair.